In this part of Focus 580, we're talking with travel writer Christopher Baker. In 1994, he signed a contract to write a guidebook on Cuba. Two books, he notes, had been published previously, and in each one of those, the authors had traveled around by car. And he says that he wanted to do something different. And so he got himself a motorcycle, got him and the bike into Cuba, and spent 3 months traveling around the country, put 7,000 miles on the motorcycle, getting to see parts of Cuba that probably a lot of other travelers would not. And he has written about his experiences in a book that came out earlier this year in the winter. The title of his book is Mimoto Fidel, Motorcycling Through Castro's Cuba, and it's published by National Geographic Adventure Press. Our guest this morning, Christopher Baker, is the author of another book in the National Geographic Travel series, that one on Costa Rica. He's also written guides to Cuba and Havana. He's a four-time winner of the Lowell Thomas Travel Journalism Award and contributes to periodicals including Newsweek and L.A. Times. He grew up in England and now makes his home in California, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk with Christopher Baker, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you would be making a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for it. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Baker, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. It's a delight to be with you.
You apparently were pretty excited at the prospect of being able to go to Cuba in the first place.
Well, absolutely. It's something I wanted to do for a long time, for many, many years. And when it finally came to fruition, let me tell you, it was one of the most exciting trips that I've ever made in my many, many years as a professional travel writer.
So what was it that you found so attractive about Cuba?
Well, firstly, I think it's because it was ostensibly off-limits, and it was an unknown quantity, and also very sensual, etc. But there was something about breaking the barrier that I was going to be going in there to write a guidebook that would help also break down barriers, I think. It was exciting in so many different ways.
Mm. And there also, I suppose, it connects with a youthful interest in socialism?
Well, that was right. You may have read the book, and certainly when I was at university, I was very left-wing by American standards. Not atypical in Europe, of course, very socialist. And so I saw Che Guevara and Fidel Castro as my heroes, and I went into Cuba with somewhat of a naive, what I now see as a naive posture, but very, very rah-rah-rah the revolution back then.
Yeah. And perhaps part of your reason, part of your interest in going by motorcycle was that, in fact, Che, one of the heroes of the revolution, did some traveling around South America. Was it Argentina?
Well, actually, he was Argentinian. He set off from Argentina, an old Norton, and traveled through Chile and up through Uruguay and into Peru. And he and his friend, traveling together, had to eventually abandon the motorcycle. But Che wrote a most magnificent, wonderful book called Che Diaries. It wasn't published until 1995. And I think Robert Redford is producing a movie of that right now. But yes, that was an inspiration in a sense.
So the idea of being able to go to Cuba and tool around on a motorcycle had some appeal on that level.
Yes, actually. And now I just realized for the first time that maybe Freud would see some connection there.
Well, and I suppose, too, the idea of the motorcycle would be great mobility, maybe greater than you would have traveling in other kinds of ways.
Very true. In fact, it got me into some backwaters that I could never have done on four wheels. And one of my most cherished memories was at the Bay of Pigs. I just visited the site of the CIA landings in 1961, visited the museum that's there. And it's in an area surrounded by mangroves and scrub. And it was late in the day, and I was heading for a city called Cienfuegos, and I knew if I kept on the road, it would be nightfall by the time I got there. So I cut through the underbrush along an enduro trail. Unfortunately, my motorcycle was an enduro, and I came across a bullet-riddled B-26 bomber in the undergrowth that I felt I was probably the first foreigner ever to see it. And that was just, I can't tell you how I felt. It was absolutely marvelous to feel that I was exploring unexplored territory.
Mm-hmm. I suppose some people knowing about Cuba and hearing about your intention to go and ride around on a motorcycle might, given the fact that fuel is rationed and the fact that if you had a problem, it might be tough to find a mechanic, and given the fact that if you needed parts, you might as well forget it. All of this was kind of taking a big risk that somewhere along the line you might have a breakdown and have to give up the whole deal.
Well, certainly not give up the whole deal, but a breakdown, yes. And in fact, I did have a breakdown, and one of the anecdotes in the book tells that story. It was not the motorcycle's fault. I had a wonderful BMW, but I'm no mechanic. But the great thing about Cubans, they are the most gracious, willing, hospitable, generous people in the world. I love them to death. And when I got into mechanical difficulties, just because I'm a total mechanical moron, a crowd gathered around, as it always did when I stopped, and they watched me fumbling with my tool kit, and in the end they just gently pushed me aside and took the tools themselves and finished the job for me, refused to accept any money. It was just a wonderful display of the graciousness of Cuban people.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose one of the things that I think everyone talks about who has been there is that all of the American automobiles from the 1950s that are still there and that of necessity people have to keep running and do all kinds of wacky things to them. So I suppose that alone should be a tribute and a testament to the mechanical abilities of Cubans.
Well, they're absolute wizards. I'm glad you've raised that because the book I'm working on right now is a photo essay book on the old American cars in Cuba. Yes, the Cubans are not permitted to own modern vehicles, and so they keep the pre-revolutionary vehicles running. And they're not always in best condition, as you can imagine. They're used on a daily basis, and parts are not available. So people actually make their own parts. They take tractor engines out of Russian tractors and put them in Cadillacs to get greater mileage because diesel is available and gasoline is very short. And they become mechanical marvels, and they're just absolute geniuses. Give them any tool and they can fix something. It might take a while to figure out, but they'll do it.
Maybe I should here real quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Christopher Baker. He's a travel writer. He's written about Costa Rica as well as Cuba, and he's the author of this book that we're talking about here that's based on his travels by motorcycle around Cuba. It's titled Mi Moto Fidel, Motorcycling Through Castro's Cuba, and it's published by National Geographic Adventure Press. And questions are welcome if you'd like to call in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that certainly comes through very, very strongly in the stories you tell in the book is almost without exception just how warm and generous and friendly the people you met were.
It's one of the finest qualities of Cuba. I'm not sure to what degree it's a result of the revolution. I think to a great degree it is. Four decades of revolutionary spirit have been absorbed by the people, but I suspect that it was a quality known of Cubans before the revolution also. And I have so many anecdotes in the book of Cubans who just demonstrated the most wonderful hospitality, the most wonderful graciousness. Let me just give you one example. Very early on in the book, just after I'd left Havana, I came across a tobacco farmer who invited me into his wife's home, or into his home, and his wife greeted me too. And they were believers in the revolution, and his wife said, "Why does America treat us so hard, etc.?" She berated America. And then as I was leaving, I didn't defend the embargo. Didn't really say anything about it, but as I was leaving, she put a whole bunch of tomatoes into my hand to take away with me. She didn't care that I was American. She understood that governmental policy is not a reflection of how individuals can relate. And for me, it was a wonderful entree to the graciousness of Cubans.
And that's perhaps a touching example, because one of the things you learn in the book is the fact that food is often very scarce and that people don't have a lot to eat, don't have a very diet, and for someone like that to share what they had with an outsider, that would be quite a generous act.
Well, in fact, Cubans get along by sharing. In fact, one of the things that upset me at first was that I never, ever heard thank you when I gave things myself. And it's partly because Cubans just take giving for granted. Not so much taking, but giving. And I have seen the most extreme examples. For example, if you witness Cuban youth together and one of them gets a Coke, they will just pass it around between them. one person buys it for themselves, they will automatically pass it around. But the extreme example I remember were two twins, twin girls, each of whom had a roller skate, one apiece.
So presumably they took turns wearing them?
Well, no, that's what I mean.
Oh, you mean they actually sort of...
one roller skate.
Oh, so they actually sort of skated holding on to each other side by side?
Oh, right, exactly.
I think one of the things that I think perhaps people have talked about in at least it was the kind of thing that we used to see in Soviet Union, perhaps we see it elsewhere in socialist societies, is that in fact they talk about it being classless and then talk about everybody being the same, but it's clear that there are haves and have-nots.
Oh, yeah.
Is that also the case in Cuba? I mean, are there some people that are very prosperous, have everything that they could want and seem to be doing very, very well?
That's absolutely true. Certainly not at a level of material accumulation of America, no. In fact, Cuba has tremendous poverty and hardship, and the vast majority of people in the cities live a very, very hard life. The governmental system has ruined the economy, and the embargo has, of course, not helped. And the government finds it very difficult to supply even meet its rations that it's supposed to give. But there are and always have been since the revolution those people who derive benefits from the revolution in favor of others. Now, one example would be you have to be or display yourself as being a good revolutionary to get by in Cuba. If you're not, you're really in a bad way because the government just cuts you out. And then there are the officials and other individuals who either through corrupt means or because they're favored because they're Communist Party members do very well. And the other exception, there are two other groups. One is sports figures and key art figures are well looked after because I think they don't want them staying in the States or Europe if they go on cultural trips, etc. So they are singularly permitted to own modern motor vehicles, for example. Nobody else is. They're allowed to retain royalties, etc. Nobody else is. And the second one is that because tourism is booming right now, bringing in dollars, individuals, for example, a doctor, let's say, who may earn, as a Cuban doctor, $20 equivalent a month, is turning to become a taxi driver or a doorman because they can get dollar tips. And Cuba is very much a dollar economy. These days, if you're a Cuban and you want toothpaste or toilet paper, you better have dollars. The government is selling to its own population in dollars, not for pesos. So this is a mad scramble for dollars. And those people who are now have gained access to contacts with tourists are gaining dollars. And so you're having a broader division of those of haves and have-nots.
Mm-hmm. And so there has been this now sprung up this little entrepreneurial economy where people are, if they can, they have this spare room, they would rent out a room. There are some people who actually have little restaurants or cafes in their homes. They apparently do whatever they possibly can do to bring in some extra money and hard currency if that's possible.
Well, sure. In fact, there's a Cuban word, resolver, to resolve. Life is so hard that Cubans get by resolving things. And those people who are renting rooms, who are now legally permitted to own restaurants, and the very few people who are permitted to self-employment, live under a very restrictive regime in terms of taxation, etc. The government had to open up to private initiatives in 1993-94 when conditions were so desperately bad in Cuba. But the Cuban economy has rebounded, much thanks to the growth of tourism, which is huge right now, by the way. And so it does not want to see successful entrepreneurs, and it's begun to squeeze most people out.
Mm. Is it possible for, how would one work it if you were an American and you wanted to go as a tourist? Can you do that?
Very easily. No more difficult than going down to Mexico. Hmm. Quite frankly, it is that easy. Now, let's deal with the legalities. It's not illegal to travel to Cuba. It's merely illegal to spend money. Okay, it's kind of catch-22. There are, however, within provisions of U.S. law, certain categories of individuals, such as myself, a journalist, who can go legally without asking the U.S. government's permission and spend money. As far as the Cubans are concerned, you don't need to do anything other than step on a plane in Jamaica, Bahamas, Mexico, or Canada, or wherever. Flights of Havana on a daily basis, and you'll get your Cuban visa as you get on the plane. And so many thousands, and I have the exact numbers at hand, many thousands of Americans choose that illegal route every year. Last year, it was about 30 or 40,000 U.S. citizens traveled to Cuba illegally, and about 160,000 American citizens went to Cuba legally. So that's about 200,000.
Mm. And is it, again, for a lot of those people, the attraction that it's a place that you're really not supposed to go? I would think that if what you wanted was a tropical beach experience, there are other places in the Caribbean that you could have that.
Sure. I'm happy to report that I think the majority of Americans who go to Cuba do so because they understand that Cuba offers them something very enriching. Most of people don't actually go because they want to make a show of breaking the embargo or breaking the law. That's not the reason. That may just add a little spice to the fire. Most people go because they understand that Cuban culture is so rich. You look at the music and the dance forms and the art that we're all very much attuned to right now, more than before, because of the success of the Buena Vista Social Club, because of the success of Chucho Valdez, etc. So there's that culture. There's also, I think, this tremendous affinity, this link that goes back to pre-revolutionary days, a desire to see Cuba, the old Cuba, as it were, before it passes away, to see those old American cars on the road, to explore what is an absolutely amazing legacy of architectural styles that goes back centuries. And yes, there are beautiful beaches. The Americans don't go for the beaches. The Canadians go for the beaches. The Italians go for the girls. The Americans, I'm happy to report, go for culture.
We have a caller to talk with, and we'll do that right now in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I've heard that Cuba has resorted to an extensive system of community gardens to help, like, feed their people after the embargo. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and tell me some more, and I'll just hang up and let you talk.
Thank you. Sure. Well, okay. Thank you very much. Yes, what happened was after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc at the end of the 80s, Cuba lost all its phosphates, all the things that it uses for agriculture, including gasoline for transportation, and malnourishment reappeared in Cuba. The situation of producing food, of moving food around, was just so devastated that there was no food available. And the state controlled, as it still does for the most part, controlled agriculture entirely, as it controls the entire economy and political system. But this condition was so bad that in 1993, they began to permit private sale of food, and they also initiated a very tremendous program of utilizing spare lots within cities for community gardens, usually on a cooperative basis of local communities. And they put in irrigation systems, etc. So that's helped remarkably in reintroducing a lot of the kinds of foodstuffs that disappeared 4 decades ago, quite frankly. Garlic, etc. This is a renowned example. Garlic disappeared from Cuba years and years and years ago. The state itself, of course, bureaucrats run the agricultural system. Remember that. Very important. And so garlic disappeared because the bureaucrats weren't thinking about growing garlic, and there were no private incentives for anybody to do so. And interestingly enough, in the mid-'80s, Castro briefly experimented with permitting private enterprise in farm system. And as we all know, the private enterprise system is the most productive system we know. And suddenly garlic reappeared in the market. And the private farmers were so successful that, of course, Castro quit the programs immediately and ranted about millionaire garlic growers. But anyway, that's off the point. Community gardens have been a great success. They're found throughout Cuba, and they've done much to put lettuce, etc., back in the hands or back on the tables of most Cubans.
We are about the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Christopher Baker. He's a travel writer. He's the author of Costa Rica in the National Geographic Traveler Guidebook Series. He's also written books on Cuba and Havana. and has written for publications including Newsweek and the LA Times. The book that we're talking about here this morning, based on his travels by motorcycle around Cuba, is titled Mi Moto Fidel, and it's published by National Geographic Adventure Press. It came out in February, so it's in bookstores if you want to look at it, and it's a good read. If you like travel writing or if you're interested in Cuba, you might pick it up and take a look at it. And questions here are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that when people talk to you about your experiences and ask questions, they're always interested in a couple of things for sure, and one would be, as you traveled around talking with Cuban people, what sort of things they told you about the United States? That is, how they felt about the United States, what they thought about it, and this the fact that officially their country was at war with the United States.
Well, officially still is, as far as Castro's concerned. Castro loves the scenario, quite frankly. I had this tremendous, surprising epiphany when I was in Cuba that he works very hard to maintain the embargo. But that's beside the point. How do Cubans feel? Cuba is a schizophrenic society. In the countryside, most, probably a majority of people still support the revolution. In the urban settings, it's very, very different. Castro hangs on by a thin thread. Most people are sick and tired of the regime. But they have mixed feelings also towards America. Cubans all heartedly love Americans. They have tremendous affinity with America. They're baseball fanatics. They follow what's going on in the American leagues. They love American things. Everybody's questing, at least the youth are questing, Nikes and Coca-Cola, etc., which are readily available for dollars in Cuba. But they understand that the embargo does not serve them well on a daily basis. But most Cubans that you will talk to, and you will never have this conversation on the street. People are too frightened to have a political conversation in the street generally, that they understand that Castro really is the one who pulls the strings on the embargo. He works very hard to maintain it. That is not to excuse Washington. I personally think the embargo is a disgrace. But it's not really the cause of the problems in Cuba. It just makes a situation worse. And I think most Cubans love Americans, and don't like the fact of what the treatment they've got from the American government, and including, and particularly, this is very relevant, how America, in a sense, stole independence from Cuba in 1898. That really plays on the Cuban psyche, as does the fact that America supported some pretty ruthless and nasty dictators during this last century, the 20th century.
Hmm. But you seem to be making the argument that, as far as Fidel Castro is concerned, that he's perfectly happy with relations continuing to be bad between Cuba and the United States, because it gives him it's useful to have this big nasty enemy here, just those few miles across the water from him.
That's true, David. Yeah, there are two reasons. One is that pragmatic reason. For his own political purposes, he wants the embargo. It serves him very well. He can jail dissidents, etc., whenever there's a major ruckus with the USA. He can blame the U.S. embargo for the tremendous devastation that he's wrought upon the Cuban economy. Etc. But also, more importantly, perhaps, and most people never even think about this, is you have to understand the psychology of Fidel Castro. I perhaps don't have time to really go into that right now, but suffice to say that his psychology is such that he sees himself as David to Goliath. This is the role he has cast himself. He is a man with the most amazingly huge ego. And he sees himself as David to Goliath. He needs Goliath to play the role of savior, just as he kind of modeled himself on José Martí, the nationalist hero of 19th century Cuba, but in a more vainglorious way. And so he loves the embargo. It's a game. He actually does see the fight, and that's how he sees it, against the USA as a game that fulfills various emotional needs that he has.
Mm-hmm. Well, here I know another one of those questions that people always ask you is, what do you think is going to happen in the future when, and we know sooner or later, Mr. Castro will pass, and that might be a time when things would change. What do you think is likely to happen in Cuba when Fidel Castro is not there anymore?
Okay, well, firstly, David, let me say that we may have all passed away before then. Castro's family are renowned for longevity. He just recently helped celebrate the 105th birthday of his auntie. He is 74 years old, and he has no intention of going anywhere. But what will happen? I keep my fingers crossed that there will not be violence that escalates into something worse, street violence. There will be street violence. I see no alternative. There will be a power feud. Raul Castro, his younger brother, is number two. He is named now to be the successor. He runs the military and the secret police. He is despised in Cuba, except by all but the most ardent revolutionaries. He does not have the charisma or the brilliance of his brother, and Fidel Castro is a genius, nor does he have any of the affection. And there is so much pent-up desire for change, a new beginning, for openness and freedom in Cuba, that when Fidel passes, those people will be out on the streets, while Raul obviously will have the police out on the streets. What the Cuban Americans do in Florida will be critical. My interpretation is probably that there are sufficient people in Cuba who understand, who desire leadership that takes Cuba in a new direction. They can't operate openly right now. Obviously, they get their heads chopped off. But Raul Castro may not last long domestically. It depends what his support is within the military. But what the Cuban Americans do in Florida is critical, and they will not be sitting back in Miami twiddling their thumbs. They will want to be in Cuba. What Washington does to support them will also be critical. I cannot envisage a scenario that has a happy beginning. I think there's going to be violence. How it will shake out, I do not know.
Yeah, given the past experience that we've seen with the United States involving itself in the politics of other countries, it's not particularly encouraging.
It's not at all encouraging. Of course, not many people are aware that USA has a history of at least three occasions after 1989 sending in troops and Marines in support of domestic governments in Cuba. And unfortunately, the extremist element of the Cuban-American community in Florida has bought Washington's opinions and support, and particularly in a Republican administration. And there are plenty of folks within that community who have their eye on the throne, who would be the next president of Cuba. And so not a good scenario at all. Moderates right now do not have a voice. There are plenty of moderate, intelligent Cuban-Americans within the Florida community, but they don't have Washington's ear. And unfortunately, the extremist element too. And they'll be in there in Cuba. They'll be trying to make sure that after Fidel, Raul does not manage to secure his position.
Yeah. I think we talked earlier about why it is that some people want to go to Cuba, and the fact that some people want to go to see it as it is now, knowing that when things change, it could change very, very quickly. And one, you know, perhaps the worst case scenario that some people might imagine is that overnight Cuba would become like Miami.
Well, that's true. In fact, you're beginning to see that already. This year, Cuba will top 2 million tourists for the first time. It got almost 2 million tourists last year. That's a lot of tourists. And their influence is quite paramount. And what's happening right now is that Cuba itself, the Cuban government, has initiated the equivalent of Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's, etc. They actually make KFC and McDonald's seem like gourmet cuisine, but that's beside the point. We are beginning to see this kind of development. Fortunately, many of the new types of buildings, and the Chinese, by the way, putting up a new high-rise hotel in downtown Havana, they're quite attractive. I have no problem with that. But I do have a problem with the wonderful Malecon Seafront Boulevard along Havana, which is quite derelict right now. It is being restored, but it has no advertisements. It has no stores, no banks of any kind. It's just beautiful old buildings, somewhat derelict. But being restored, as I say, I do not like to think of the Malecon with its KFCs and its McDonald's and its neon advertising signs. And that's inevitable. It's the future of the world, unfortunately. It's already happening.
we have some other callers to bring into the conversation, and we'll do that in the order they came in. They're both in Urbana. We'll start line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What would be the best policy for the U.S. government? Simply to remove the embargo and more or less ignore Cuba, or what would you suggest for the future of Cuba?
Well, I think the sanest policy, thank you for your question. I think the sanest policy is for Washington to begin to prepare for a day when Fidel has passed. And the only way to do that, I feel, is to lift the embargo and to have whatever moderating influence it can. Now, I want to say this. If the U.S. embargo is lifted as a unilateral decision, for example, from Washington, I don't believe it will really change things, because Fidel Castro is the man who determines what foreign corporations enter Cuba. I personally believe that he does not want to see U.S. corporations in Cuba. And some of his rationales are very sound rationales. One of the wonderful things that the Cuban Revolution has done and Fidel Castro has done, he has protected Cuban cultural integrity. If you look at Puerto Rico, and I'm currently writing a book on Puerto Rico, you see the traffic jams and the McDonald's and KFCs and Pizza Huts everywhere. This is what he's protected Cuba from. Now, for various reasons, some of which I've already mentioned, if the U.S. embargo is lifted, I actually don't think Castro will permit U.S. corporations, with some exceptions, to go into Cuba. So things will not change overnight. But nonetheless, I really do think Washington needs to begin to engage Castro on a non-antagonistic basis, even though I believe Castro enjoys that basis. It has to begin to reach out. It has to reach out to the moderates and listening to the moderate Cuban-American voice in Florida, and it has to negotiate directly, just as we're doing with North Korea these days, certainly as we've been doing with Vietnam and China for some time. That's the only route, sane route, that will help to avoid the kind of catastrophic potential scenario in a post-Castro setting that I previously described.
How much sympathy is there in Cuba for the Cuban expatriates in Florida?
I don't think there's much. Let me say this. Most Cubans, if they do not have family members who have left, know people who do. I think they have tremendous empathy for those who made the difficult journey by raft, for example, and they're somewhat jealous that they can't enjoy some of the levels of living, for example, that are offered in American society. The Cuban press, the Cuban media are obviously full of very negative commentary about the Cuban-American community, which, let's face it, the Elian Gonzalez scenario gave a perfect example of their extremism. And they lost a tremendous degree of support in the USA, whatever support they had amongst the general population, and certainly in Cuba. I think most Cubans are aware that the extremist element of the Cuban-American community in Florida would probably have little sympathy for the kind of socialist health system and the kind of education system, etc. And they're very fearful that most people have gained some benefits from health, education, etc., that they would lose those qualities of life if the Cuban Americans came back and managed to position somebody in Fidel's throne.
At one time, at least, many of the early expatriates were actually affiliated with the mafia. What danger was there of the mafia moving back into Cuba?
Would the mafia come back? Well, I'm sure that be it the mafia in America, more likely the mafia in Italy, I think, or even Colombia, and that would be a desperately terrible scenario. Certainly there are individuals within the Cuban-American community in Florida who have very strong ties to the old Batista regime and even perhaps to mobsters. I don't want to overplay that. I think that the whole mobster scenario has been overplayed, quite frankly, period. But I wouldn't want to see it. I don't see the mafia coming back in from the States, probably Italy or Colombia very quickly. It obviously depends on what kind of form of government succeeds Fidel's government.
Chaos would be the worst possible scenario, I suppose, for that.
What would be, I'm sorry?
Chaos following.
Oh, chaos, yes. Heaven forbid that chaos happens, but it's going to be a very difficult thing, I think, to avoid chaos, quite frankly. If Raoul manages to suppress the kind of expression that will be out on the streets for a new change in the way that he can do and will do using the military, it will be a very bloody affair, I'm sure. And as I say, I can't really see, under contemporary conditions, a very easy, fluid way, following Fidel's passing, for a new society or a new government to sustain itself without bloodshed.
Perhaps Raoul will die first.
I'm sorry?
Perhaps Raoul will die first.
Raoul?
Mm-hmm.
Probably. What was interesting, the last time I was in Havana or throughout Cuba about 3 months ago, for the first time I noticed that the rallies that they're having every weekend right now, anti-American rallies throughout the nation, one is beginning to see throughout Cuba for the first time not just Viva Fidel, but Viva Fidel y Viva Raúl, which suggests there is already preparation perhaps for the day of Raúl becoming number one.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's continue. Here's another person in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah. Keeping in mind that you're a travel writer, I don't know if I buy your idea that the embargo is such a great thing for Fidel personally, because even given your idea that it's an ego thing and all this, I would guess, I think Noam Chomsky would, has aired this same opinion that there'd be far more to gain by being an example to the rest of the hemisphere, a positive example. And furthermore, when you reduce eliminating the embargo to essentially foreign investment, you keep talking about how Castro wants to keep out the KFCs and the Pizza Huts, etc. I mean, that isn't the only way for foreign trade to go. It doesn't necessarily have to involve American corporations going in. And also, when you say that the people in Miami are going to have a lot to say about what happens when Castro is no longer with us, I was referring to what has been called the best on this side of the, on our side, the best biography of Castro, The Guerrilla Prince, The Untold Story of Fidel Castro by Georgianne Geyer.
Uh-huh.
I know in there she says that there's no way that exiles, or at least in an interview in relation to that book's coming out in 1991, she's quite sure that there's no way that the exiles or expatriates are going to be the ones who will rule Cuba in the future or have very much to do with it, for basically because he's been in power so long that Cuba has changed so much. She points out that it's now, almost half or even more black, and she says that and this was a lot of research went into this, so she's kind of extrapolating from that to give opinions about the future here. But she says that they're not hardly going to welcome, quote, upper class white Cubans from Miami who haven't been there for 30 years as their next political ruling class. So I think, that's kind of wishful thinking. So you might want to comment, but I did have a question after that.
Okay, great. I appreciate those comments. I'm very familiar with Gaia's book, Guerrilla Prince. She actually makes the very strongest arguments of anybody I've heard about why Fidel loves the embargo as a game. But you're absolutely right in terms of the white upper echelon of the Cuban American community, not being welcomed in Cuba by so many of the Cubans, probably even a vast majority of the Cubans, who are very fearful of what they'll bring. But nonetheless, my argument was that they're not going to be sitting on their thumbs, because they firmly believe themselves, I'm talking about the Cuban Americans in Florida, that they have the, in a sense, preordained right to dictate what will follow Fidel, and they currently have Washington's backing, and therefore they cannot be dismissed as a sideline entity. They will be powerful players in what follows Fidel, for good or bad, probably for bad, but only time will tell. And you have a question?
Well, yeah, I think what you just essentially said was the U.S. will play a large role, may play a large role, and that the Miamians will have the U.S.'s ear, which is kind of a different thing. But I was just curious, if you were there when Castro threatened to go to the WTO in Seattle, it caused a ruckus up here, and I guess what I'm looking for is, as a tourist down there, just how attuned were you to what was going on internationally?
I don't see myself as a tourist, by the way. I've made about 20 visits to Cuba. I go in about 4 times a year, so spend a lot of time in Cuba, and I keep myself very much abreast, whether I'm at home or in Cuba, of what's going on politically. Yes, I was well aware of the Seattle scenario. I'm aware of Castro's praise for the demonstrators in Quebec recently, etc. As I see it, and this is not to exonerate Washington of any of its ploys and plays towards Castro and Cuba, but the way I see it, Castro loves to take a jibe at the USA and blame it for things that it's not necessarily to blame for, and he loves stirring the tiger. When the tiger goes to sleep, he pokes it. It's a game.
But did the Cubans know that he was thinking about going to the WTO in Seattle? And then, if so, how did he explain not going?
Yes, they were, actually, and he explained it as he couldn't guarantee his safety against assassination attempts, if I recall it, or of him being detained, as was Pinochet in London.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. And I think, actually, the time that you went to Cuba in 1997, that you write about in this book, in fact, this was a time when there was great tension between the two countries, because it was just after the Cubans shot down these planes that were flown by this American group.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, it was end of February 1996. Very important, because even though that journey by motorcycle, it was my 5th or 6th journey into Cuba at the time, I still went into Cuba at that time very much of a supporter of the revolution. I still believe the revolution has done some wonderful things. Very rah-rah-rah up Fidel as a supporter. And it was critical, because the week before I went into Cuba, those two planes had been shot down, as you suggested. I was in Cuba during a period when there was incredible tension between the USA and Cuba. Cuba was on high alert. The USA had warships in the Straits of Florida. And the reason for that was the shooting down of those two planes happened by no coincidence during the Republican primaries in Florida during the presidential election. The end result was, within 2 weeks, Clinton was forced to sign a bill that Jesse Helms rushed through Congress that Clinton had threatened he would never, ever sign into law. But because it was presidential year and Florida Cuban Americans were up in arms demanding action against Castro, Clinton was forced to sign a bill he detested to win or lose Florida, basically to try and win Florida during the election period. That bill, the Helms-Burton bill, had tremendous impact in terms of raising the embargo and or increasing the terms of the embargo. And I realized when I was in Cuba, I was trying to make sense of it, because the Clinton administration was trying a new easier route with Havana. It was reaching out to Castro in some ways, and I thought, if this is what Castro wants, he he continues to harp on about he wants a new beginning with America. Why on earth did he shoot down those two planes during the election period? And he knew it would result in the Helms-Burton Law. Well, that was exactly it. He knew it would result in the passage of the Helms-Burton Law because he is a brilliant chess player. Gabriel Garcia Marquez has said that he has the most incredible ability to foresee the consequences of an event to its furthest reaches. And so he played America on that one. And it made me realize, I had a tremendous epiphany, oh my God, he shot down those two planes on purpose. And I was later vindicated. It was called Operation Scorpion. FBI, etc., all figured it all out. Took 2 years, but that was the scenario. Mm.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and given the fact that it's dangerous to make sweeping assumptions about people and places, having said that, it's also true that people and places do seem to have spirits that set them apart from other people, so that when you go certain places, you do have this, you know, you do want to say, yeah, I can tell you what these people are like, what the place is like, and this is it. If one was going to do that about Cuba, how does one describe it? What would you say in a few lines really would define Cuba and its people?
I think that's very easy. I think most people who go to Cuba cry. They cry because they are so uplifted by the generosity, the vivaciousness, and the spirit of the Cuban people facing such difficulties, and they do face difficulties, but they know how to enjoy life. They know how to communicate as human beings to human being, and they really display that as much as any people I know, in a way that just leaves you, renders you feeling like you have just visited some kind of utopia, social utopia. And I don't want to say that in a sense that endorses Castro's revolution as firmly as it may be interpreted, but that people in Cuba are just the most incredibly hospitable, gracious sensualists, too. We didn't even talk about sensuality.
Mm-hmm. It's a place that seems to be very seductive in a very literal sort of way.
Absolutely, and the setting, it's like a Hollywood stage set that was abandoned in 1959. Absolutely incredible surroundings.
Well, there's much more we could talk about, but unfortunately, we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. For people who want to read the book, it's titled Mimoto Fidel, Motorcycling Through Castro's Cuba, published by National Geographic Adventure Press by Christopher Baker. And Mr. Baker, thank you very much.
David, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.